From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn how accidental shootings and the charges that follow are transforming the lives of Milwaukee families. Then, we'll tell you about Milwaukee County's Veterans Treatment Court and how vets can benefit from these special courts.
I think it's really understandable that they are at risk at higher levels for something like substance abuse, mental health symptoms and diagnoses, increased at risk for domestic violence, and just being sensitive to the contributing factors.
Then we examine the negative impacts of diet culture.
A lot of dieting kind of starts off casual, but then certain individuals, it does get taken to another level and it can become a diagnosable eating disorder.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Accidental shootings account for a small percentage of the shooting deaths and accidents in Wisconsin, but the impact can be devastating. Although they account for just 1% of overall shooting incidents, the number jumps to 5% for children. These shootings can often play out in a predictable and terrifying way. A parent or guardian has an unsecured gun in the home, a child finds the firearm, and then shoots themselves or another person. But the fallout from these incidents can add more devastation, especially here in Milwaukee, where the parents and guardians responsible are routinely charged with felonies. This issue is at the heart of a piece recently published by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Investigative reporter John Diedrich shares more on the issue with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
In these cases, are parents always charged? Is that pretty regular for a parent to be charged if they are responsible for, I guess, owning the gun?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there is often criminal justice charges. There's charges in the system filed. What we did is we looked at all of the incidents in Wisconsin over an 8-year period. These are not tabulated or added up by police in a very systematic way. So there's different layered approach that we had to try to figure out what happened in these cases. We did find some cases where parents were not charged. And in those kind of circumstances, they stood out as the minority. More often, parents are charged. And that includes outside of Milwaukee and in Milwaukee County. What's important to note as we looked through it was how charges varied depending on what county you were in the state. In Milwaukee, we have roughly half of these incidents in the state. So while Milwaukee County is big, that's an oversized number. That's a disproportionately high number. There's also a different approach that happens in Milwaukee County. Since 2017, almost every one of these cases were charged as a felony, regardless if the child died or was injured. Usually the person who is charged is a person who is related to the child. That's usually mom or dad. And outstate, same defendant pool, it's much more common for misdemeanors to be charged. There are felonies that are charged outstate, but the rate at which it's charged within Milwaukee County is much higher.
When you say outstate, you mean in the rest of Wisconsin?
That's right. Outstate is basically the other 71 counties. So it's not in terms of the rest of Wisconsin other than Milwaukee is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. In Milwaukee County, what's the rationale for charging parents, caretakers, whoever might be responsible with a felony?
So I spoke at length with the deputy district attorney who supervises these cases. He personally prosecutes many of them and also supervises the teams that do. Matthew Torbenson, who's the deputy district attorney. He's been in the office for about 20 years. He's handled cases of child abuse this entire time. And these cases, he's prosecuted them actually as misdemeanors. Under a law, there's a 1991 law in Wisconsin that says this is misdemeanor behavior. And he used that law along with other prosecutors. Over time, what he came to believe is that this is conduct that is warranting of a felony because death is possible, it happens, and a great bodily harm is likely as well. And it's also highly preventable. Also, a felony conviction, what that means is a lifetime prohibition of having a gun. So that's a deliberate effort that Matt Torbenson told me he's seeking as he's seeking a felony conviction. What's interesting is that the majority of defendants in these cases do not have any criminal background. There are felons, and so they're going to be charged with felon in possession. There are people who are involved in drug dealing. They're going to be charged with that as well. But a lot of the people that we found in here do not have criminal backgrounds. And so when they're charged with a felony, sometimes they'll plead guilty to something less than, but in the end, they'll end up with probation, which sounds like it's not that big of a deal. But we did, through telling the stories of people, talked about how life-changing it is. So in this piece, what we're really trying to explore is the different sort of points of view. So you have like Matthew Torbenson talking about he's seen these autopsy photos. He's seen highly avoidable deaths and injuries. And then you have parents who are feeling a lot of trauma and challenges in their life as a result of these charges.
I'd like to get back to the specific woman you look at in this piece in just a moment. But you mentioned one of the motives in charging a felony seems to be that it would remove access to firearms. Would you say that's the main motivation? And this is my own naivete, but are there other ways of getting that result without charging a felony?
Well, that is a primary function. I mean, that's what Torbenson said, is that that's a goal. I mean, also that felony charges connote the seriousness, of the conduct. But yeah, he said that's a deliberate effort. He wasn't surprised by these numbers. He had a hand actually in changing state law because this is felony child neglect. And he had a hand in changing that statute to allow for application in these kinds of cases. But, you ask a good question because this has been asked, is there a way to limit or remove access to firearms? So this is a constitutional right that there's prohibitions that are spelled out, and those are federal, and they say, you can't own a gun if you're convicted of a felony. That if it's unreversed, that's for life. Where firearms can be removed for a period of time, you could be on probation. It could be the result of supervision. You could be prosecuted under certain misdemeanors. There could be a temporary prohibition on firearms. And actually, in these cases, there's training that's required, firearms training. And there's also parenting classes and things of that nature. So even in cases where people don't end up with felony convictions for a time, they're not able to legally possess firearms.
But that tends to be temporary.
That's right.
You focus on how an accidental shooting impacted one woman's life, one family. Can you explore what happened with her situation, why she owned a gun to begin with, and how things unfolded as charges were levied against her?
So her name is Brianna Givens. Brianna Givens is the mother of three children. And the reason she bought a gun was in 2020, she was involved in an incident. Her cousin took her into a situation that got very dangerous very fast. She didn't know that that was going to be happening. He was in a dispute with somebody. She thought they were going somewhere else, the grocery store, and it ended up being in a very dangerous situation. She had a gun put to her head. She was kidnapped for a period of time, jumped out of a moving car, and scurried to safety. She called police from the hospital. She was able to identify. She felt like the defendants, clearly, her identification was not sufficient and nobody was charged in the case. So this is why she bought a gun, is that she was very concerned for her safety. And she had actually owned a gun earlier and her other gun had been stolen. So she was familiar. She had gone through training. She had a gun safe at one point. She didn't have one when this happened in October of 2020. But what happened that particular day was that she's a nurse. This is during the pandemic, and working long days, and had sciatica, had back pain. And so she stopped at the urgent care on the way home and was prescribed a muscle relaxant. So when she got home, she had a routine of what she would do, and that would be to ensure all the children, including her 2-year-old Destin, was asleep before she went to bed. But this night, when she took the muscle relaxant, she fell asleep before. The reason that's important is her gun, which is loaded, was under the mattress. And her son was able to get it out and shot himself in the hand. So she calls 911. She's a nurse, so she's like trying to administer care. It went through the webbing between his index finger and his thumb. A lot of blood, and she was caring for him. The police came in. She was immediately arrested, and she was taken to jail while paramedics tended to her her son. So she's in jail for 5 days. And then what transpired when she comes out is felony charges are going to be filed against her. And that leads to a whole series of events. She ends up losing her job because as a nurse, pending felony neglect charges lead to suspension without pay. She was evicted. She was homeless for a while. Her kids stayed with her mom. So in addition to losing her job, she also had to withdraw from nursing school where she was. And ultimately, she pled out to a misdemeanor, but it's a neglect misdemeanor. And so again, that neglect count is making it very hard for her to work. She has not been able to get a job in healthcare or education for that matter. And today she's back to tending tables, which she did when she was a teenager. I do want to say that she stands up to say, I absolutely messed up. I should have had a gun safe. I should have used it. I tell everybody to do that now. And absolutely something should have happened. She questions, did I have to be charged with a felony? And in the end, was there another way to sort of resolve the case than have this thing on my record?
It does seem like the fallout ultimately put her in a situation that was even more vulnerable. Some of that punishment, the kind of unintended consequences, seem to have caused further damage to a family that had already been damaged.
That's an interesting point of view, and I've heard that it's taking the longer view is what you're doing there, I think, of how charges play out. And so a lot of times as a reporter, I'm seeing the short term. And so what this project allowed me to do was go deeper in and understand, a case that ends in probation could have all these reverberating effects. I didn't mention that Child Protective Services came over. And so for a time, she had an interaction with them. There was separation from her children. And again, some people would say, absolutely, what was done was reckless and negligent. And it does seem a little different than the malnourishment cases that we sometimes hear about, which are also charged under this, you know, or failure to get medical care or things of that nature. But that's the theory. And I think what you're alluding to is important to keep in mind is that, and this was raised as the downstream effects, the reverberating effects that these have, especially when you have families that are really dependent upon the mom is in the center of this. And that was certainly the case with Breonna Givens, is that she's a central. And I should say she's not the only one I talked to. Her story was the one that I highlighted. But this was a pretty common scenario that I came across in the, you know, half dozen cases of people that I talked to. And I was in court and so forth. Different details and so forth, but same sort of downstream thing. And I guess what it does is it really creates, you know, cycles of difficulty and trauma. And again, from the prosecutor's point of view and police and so forth, they said, well, something needs to happen here. A child got a dangerous item, you know, and that shouldn't happen. And so there has to be some justice and maybe deterrence for others.
Yeah. When it comes to this idea of being a deterrent, do we have any evidence of the efficacy of that?
Well, it's an interesting question. For some time, so child access protection laws is what we're talking about, or safe storage laws. These have been coming in since the late 80s. Wisconsin was actually a pretty early adopter of those in 1991. And now we have more than half the country. Various sorts are out there. And there's different advocacy groups that are advancing CAP laws, so-called CAP laws. And there's evidence, there's research that says that these laws lead to lower instances of these kinds of shootings involving children. In other words, gun owners are changing their storage practices based on the concern that they might be jailed as a result of this or go to prison. At the heart of this is the question, is fear of being locked up greater than a concern for your child's well-being? That's sort of at the heart of this thing. And there's new research that questions some of the earlier research. Dr. Miller out of Northeastern and Harvard, his team found they couldn't find that effect that earlier research had found. What he found was that gun owners are not aware of the laws of their state. And if they are, there wasn't evidence that they were changing their storage practices. Now, Dr. Miller said, I'm all in favor of the intent behind these laws. But I think the idea that the flat statement that these laws save lives, he just said the data does not support that. And so I think at this point where it lands is that there's these efforts to pass the law and to enforce, which are having some downstream significant effects on folks. And I think some of the reconsideration, as I'm talking to folks like Dr. Miller, are should we be thinking more preventative, getting upstream, rather than putting all of our effort into the laws themselves?
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you, Joy. My pleasure.
John Diedrich is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. At WUWM.com, you can find our previous conversation with Diedrich about gun deaths in Wisconsin. A New York judge founded the nation's first veterans treatment court in 2008 in response to the growing number of veterans appearing on his docket who were struggling with addiction or mental illness. Milwaukee County's specialty court for veterans started 4 years later, and hundreds of veterans have graduated from the program. WUWM's Mayon Silver speaks with Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Carolina Stark, who presides over the court.
There's research that really teaches us and supports that veterans are at a higher risk for things like substance use disorder and for suicide. And, you know, there's research to support it, and I think it's really important for the treatment court to use, right, those evidence-based models and make decisions in our practices based on that evidence and that research. But it's also, I think, you know, if we just think about it as human beings, experiences that veterans go through, right, whether they're combat service-related or otherwise, that transition back to civilian life after they've experienced the multitude of experiences that come along with serving our country, I think it's really understandable, you know, not good, but understandable that they have or are at risk at higher levels, I should say, for something like substance abuse, mental health symptoms and diagnoses, increased at risk for domestic violence, and just being sensitive to the contributing factors to the criminal conduct, not to excuse criminal conduct, not to disregard the importance, right, and the focus that we always have still on public safety and accountability. But when really looking at, you know, what is the contributing factor to the criminal behavior, and is there something that research shows we can do to change that and make individuals and communities safer and healthier? So just understanding that for that specific veteran population, it can be really significant that their service to country has contributed to putting them at a higher risk for some of these things.
So treatment courts are meant to sort of address that, and they don't really work in the traditional adversarial litigation-based model. It's more of a non-adversarial approach. Can you describe for people how that works?
Yeah, so you're right, Mayan. It looks and feels very different than if you are in what I would call a traditional court. So try to maybe to briefly contrast the traditional court from the veterans court and that treatment court model. In a traditional court, right, that's very adversarial and litigation tracked, like focusing right on that exchange of evidence, if there are legal motions to be maybe heard before the court about what type of evidence is admissible, right, presenting evidence to a jury in a trial. As contrasted to a treatment court model, again, participation in any of our treatment courts, including Veterans Treatment Court, is voluntary. A defendant, a veteran, is represented by, right, their attorney, their criminal defense attorney. They have had an opportunity, right, to discuss with their attorney their legal rights and options. And for those who choose to participate in Veterans Court, they have chosen to giving up that right to a trial. They've entered a guilty plea or sometimes guilty pleas to multiple charges and have committed to and accepted the terms and conditions of the treatment court model. And then we're focusing, right, in a very collaborative way, a sharing of information, and the judge really engaging in every hearing directly with the participant. That's a huge part of treatment court that we don't see in the traditional courts, where the judges are really engaging more with the attorneys on the legal issues, whereas in treatment court, that judge in the courtroom is really engaging with the veteran to give them a lot of praise and encouragement for the things that they are doing well, like attending treatment, providing their drug testing samples, maintaining hopefully their sobriety, but then also having accountability from the judge if they are not complying with the requirements, and then the judge deciding what the responses should be to that. And so it's a much more collaborative, especially in terms of the information sharing, and then much different in the judge's engagement with the individual defendants, the individual participants.
Yeah, I noticed that it's called graduation when someone completes their Veterans Court journey.
Yeah, it is. It's a celebration of an accomplishment. When our veterans graduate from treatment court, they have completed usually a really, really significant series of requirements. Not anything that is light or easy to accomplish. And they go through, many of our veterans go through different phases where they have to complete certain requirements in each phase to move to the next phase. And so by the time we get to a successful completion of a treatment court requirement, which is usually participation is a minimum of 12 months. Sometimes it can go, you know, maybe 14, 16, 18 months, depending on the individual, their circumstances, their progress. But it is really a celebration, and we do call it a graduation, to just recognize the commitment that they've made, the work they've put into it, the things that they have accomplished.
And I was intrigued by the fact that one of the goals of Veterans Court is to reignite the core values of military service into veteran participants' daily routines. Can you explain that and explain maybe how some of the traits that someone learns through military service can help or maybe sometimes even hinder the progress of a veteran who's also been accused of a crime?
In veterans treatment court, as compared or contrasted to our adult drug treatment court, you know, really focusing on that veteran-centered care and response. And for many veterans, I don't know if for all veterans, but for many veterans, they do continue throughout their life, I think, to think about and value the core values that they learned in their particular branches of military, whether that is, you know, commitment to a mission, right? So can we think of completing these treatment court requirements as their current mission? Commitment to country and community, right? And when we think about someone who has chosen to serve our country in the military and the amount of commitment that that takes and the big life changes that that requires, those can translate right to really successful participation in treatment court as well when they're making a big commitment and they are making big changes to their life, such as, you know, complying with these testing requirements that happen usually multiple times per week, or complying to treatment requirements that can be up to a requirement for residential treatment, right? Like taking away time from or time away from work or family to engage in a very high level of care. But also, I think for veterans who have chosen to serve our country, there is an underlying commitment and value to community. And I think many times we can tap into that and build in that as they think about, you know, what brought them to Veterans Court, that criminal charge, and their value of service to community, and how working through treatment court is not only important but to themselves individually and to their family, but also to their community.
And you've talked about the importance of the judge-participant relationship throughout this process. You have personal experience as a family member of a veteran. Can you tell us about that and how that sort of colored or influenced your term in this role?
Sure. So while I have not made the commitment, right, to serve country as a member of our military, my dad is a Marine, right, served in the Marine Corps. And one of the really special, meaningful, I think, connections that I have to Veterans Treatment Court is that my dad serves, his name is Ken Wilhite, so I'll throw that out there for dad. He serves as a mentor, a veteran mentor for the Veterans Treatment Court in the Sheboygan County Circuit Court. And he started that before I was assigned to preside over our treatment courts here in Milwaukee. For me, that started in August of 2022. And so I've had an opportunity, right, just in watching and listening to my dad talk about not only military service and country in general, but as he was participating, right, as a Veterans Treatment Court mentor before I was able to serve as the judge in a Veterans Treatment Court, I just learned a lot from what he was able to share. Of course, there are some things he can't share about what he talks with his mentees, but how meaningful it was not only to those veteran court participants, but how meaningful it was to him as well, as a veteran, to continue to support, right, like that camaraderie that is many times, right, important to our veterans and those in military service. And so it's just a kind of cool special connection that motivates me individually to have requested this assignment, but that motivates me to serve in it as well.
And we know that there are these devastating racial disparities in the justice system. A report by the Sentencing Project found that despite Black people accounting for just 6% of Wisconsin's population, they make up 42% of the state's prison population and are incarcerated at 12 times the rate of white people. Veterans Treatment Court and other treatment courts, you know, what's their role in doing things to help address this disparity?
I think one of the really important things for our treatment courts, whether we're talking about our Veterans Treatment Court, our Mental Health Treatment Court, or our Adult Drug Treatment Court, is to make sure that we are inclusive, right, of all of the individuals who are otherwise eligible. And I say otherwise eligible because, remember, participation in treatment court is voluntary. It's a legal decision, right, that someone has to make after they've been accused of a crime or charged of a crime, even if they meet all of the eligibility criteria. It's a choice that they would have to make after consultation with their attorney. But making sure that we are mindful of both, whether it's kind of either a more obvious bias or maybe those implicit biases, systemic biases, making sure that we're using, right, like validated assessment tools, that we're not just going on our personal judgment about whether we think someone should be in treatment court or not, how, you know, not just like a feeling we have, but using the validated assessment tools, using our eligibility criteria, making sure that we are, right, reaching out to all of the members of the community who could be eligible for treatment court and their attorneys to let them know, right, of this option and to encourage them, if it's something they're interested in, to do the referral to our Veterans Treatment Court coordinator so we can go through that kind of referral eligibility process and, right, trying just to make sure that hopefully our numbers in terms of participation, you know, that goal to match, I guess, the breakdown in the community, whether that's gender, race, or other demographic factors, to make sure that we are being both accessible and inclusive and fair.
Judge Carolina Stark, thank you so much for speaking to us about Veterans Court.
Well, thank you so much, Mayan, again, for the opportunity to share this information with the community.
Judge Carolina Stark presides over the Milwaukee County Veterans Treatment Court. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver last year. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the Wisconsin origin story of the popular role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons. But first, we need to talk about food. The hosts of the podcast, Food, We Need to Talk, join us to talk about the problems and pitfalls with diet culture. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The holiday season is upon us, and with that comes big meals, maybe some treats we wouldn't normally eat at other times of the year, and that's followed up with New Year's resolutions, sometimes based around diet and exercise. But how we think about food can have a negative impact on how we feel about eating, something we all need to do to live. For Una Jada, food was something she struggled with for a long time. But after doing some research, she discovered that the science of diets wasn't complicated or contested. The problem is the right things weren't communicated very well. So Jada teamed up with Harvard Medical School Associate Professor Dr. Eddie Phillips, and together they've been hosting the WBUR podcast, Food, We Need to Talk. Since 2019, they've shared a science-based and humor-laced approach to health and fitness. They shared about this approach to food with me last year. So eating and food isn't just a scientific topic, of course. I mean, that could be first and foremost, but I feel like it's also an emotional one, right? So what fundamental guidelines do you both share when it comes to talking about and sharing information surrounding food and nutrition?
I think it is a very emotional topic. And for us, I think a big thing we've learned is to not be super strict about any of the food rules we talk about. So there is a lot of things that we all agree on about nutrition, but I think an even bigger thing is that moderation is so important, and that not being too drastic about any sort of food decisions or food changes you're making is just as important to your mental health as it is to your physical health to be eating healthy. So I think the biggest thing for me is to not be super like red line, black lines, like everything black and white about food decisions the way I used to be.
So I agree with you, Audrey, that it is the most emotional of our health behaviors. I often talk to audiences, and we speak on the podcast, Food, We Need to Talk, about lots of other things besides food. And you don't get the kind of emotion when we suggest that people should go to bed earlier, and you should exercise, and cigarettes are bad, and stress should be managed, and everyone nods their heads. And then you start talking about food, and people run to their various camps.
They lose their mind. Yeah.
And they start saying, are you like this or that? Are you whole food, plant-based? Are you carnivore? Are you keto? And like, there's nothing in between. And we try to calm the emotion by saying there's so much more that we agree upon in terms of what to eat.
Right. Because there can be a sense of someone feeling attacked or a certain vilification if someone's body doesn't respond to something that someone else's body does.
Yeah. I think like this idea of if you are not eating the same diet as I am, like we're against each other. It kind of feels like politics in a way. And I think it doesn't matter what you read is healthy or unhealthy in a book. Like, you shouldn't feel like it's a moral judgment upon yourself if it's not the same as the way you eat. So I really try to make sure that in our language, we don't seem judgmental of the way other people are eating. Because like the fact is, everybody's eating choices are their own decision. And health is not the only reason people make their eating choices they're making. So it's like, at the end of the day, everybody is going to eat whatever is best for them and fits them the best.
Absolutely. And Una, you went through your own personal journey like a lot of us do. You're on the tiring and overwhelming years-long trudge of trying to be, quote, skinny before taking a deep dive into the science of nutrition and exercise. So can you share a bit about what led you to talk to WBUR and then what led to the podcast, Food We Need to Talk?
Yeah, so I always grew up with two sisters that were pretty thin. So I was never overweight growing up. I just always wanted to be thinner. And in high school, that was just some mild restriction. But as I went into college, my parents weren't there anymore. It led to very severe restriction. So then I was only eating like 1,000 calories a day. And of course, I would get so hungry, it would lead to binge eating. So all through college, I was kind of battling extreme restriction and then binge eating. And so I gained weight pretty consistently throughout college, which would just lead to more severe restriction. So eventually I had like actual severe eating disorders. I feel like a lot of dieting kind of starts off casual, but then certain individuals, it does get taken to another level and it can become a diagnosable eating disorder. And so then the thing that kind of helped pull me out of it was discovering lifting weights at the gym, because when I started to do it, I was like, whoa, this is so fun. Up until that point, the gym had only been my way of trying to get smaller. And then when I started to actually feel stronger, it made me feel so much more confident. I was like, okay, like if I'm going to the gym, I need to eat enough protein. I need to eat enough food because I need to fuel the workouts. And so that kind of shifted my whole mentality around food was always supposed to be restricted and exercise is only to burn calories. And so once I had that big mindset shift, I started to read a lot more literature in nutrition and exercise and discovered that it really wasn't that controversial or convoluted as it seems online. And that's why I reached out to WBUR and said like, guys, you should be talking about this research because we need an authoritative source of health information that's not people on Instagram.
Yeah, and then bringing in Dr. Phillips into the fold, can you share a bit more about how you two partnered up to do this podcast and kind of the way you wanted to go about this?
So I'll add my sort of personal, you know, family interest in the eating disorders is in that my wife and myself, previously identified as we, have always been all about eating healthy, clean eating, kind of following the trends and the vitamins, et cetera. And when our kids came along, that became in the mind and the the soul and the being of our middle child, orthorexia, which is sort of a newly described straight eating or clean eating, which lapsed into, for her, anorexia. And even though my wife and I are both trained physicians, this is something that we were, you know, seemingly powerless to help with and, had contributed to in some way. So Una and I were introduced at WBUR in Boston because I'd done a previous podcast there called The Magic Pill. And then Una came along and our fairy godmother, we call her, the reporter, Carrie Goldberg, matched us up and said, you know, let's see how you do. And the rest from there, as they say, is history in a good way, because Yuna's about the same age as my middle daughter. And we have a quasi-parental relationship in which, you know, the fun part is I can talk to Yuna about things that are so emotionally charged and get a straight response rather than trying to dance on that, you know, that third rail of emotions with my own kids. So that became the podcast and then the book.
Yeah. So leading into the book, and you both had been doing the podcast since 2019, but then in embarking upon a book, what did you learn about one another when it came to writing a book together? Because that's a different working relationship. So what were some challenges you worked through or some surprising things you learned about each other as partners?
Oh my God, what an interesting one. I don't think you guys asked us this question before. I guess I kind of learned that Eddie is like very good at editing and I hate editing. And I didn't realize that we kind of like complimented each other in that way. So I love writing and then I don't want to see it again after I've written it. It's so tedious to me. And Eddie was like so good about like, he wanted to read everything I wrote and like would help me fix it. And it was just really generous, I feel like, because to me, it's such a chore to edit things. And then also, just Eddie is very optimistic, which I already knew even from working with him on the podcast. He's always just an optimist. But even in the book, like we always had crazy deadlines. We're, of course, always behind on crazy deadlines. And I feel like, Eddie, there's no way this is going to get done. He'd be like, no, it's okay. We'll figure it out. It'll happen. And I was like, oh my God, this man is crazy. But it did get done. So he's always right in the end. But I learned how much of an optimist Eddie is even in times of crisis.
The other thing I'll share is that part of what makes the podcast so much fun and we believe or we've heard so entertaining to listeners is that our perspectives are remarkably different and our voices are about as different as they could be. And when you go to read the book, it was described to us as being, quote, very voicey, which I think was a compliment because we realized that there was no way that we were going to kind of come together on a unified text. So we intentionally stuck with Una can report on something and I will react. And then there were certain things like a conversation with my daughter, as I described about her anorexia, that I just needed to write that alone and devote a full chapter to it. But when we got to exercise, like I had so much to say about my exercise that, you know, I wanted to express in my voice. So I think what I learned is that what makes the relationship so much fun is our difference of opinions, our difference in voices, and to actually maintain that into the book and to play off of each other. I also learned that it's really fun and we were both pretty quick and humorous. It's a lot harder to write humor. And Una is remarkable at it. I would read a draft and burst out laughing on the first draft. And it helped me loosen up my writing. So that's what I learned working with Una.
Well, and you've taken years of talking to experts into this book. So What are some of your main simple actionable tips or takeaways that you want to share with the audience to help them move into a healthier direction when it comes to eating, making peace with our body, and just coming at this with a little more grace for ourselves?
So I think people get so frustrated as though their bodies are betraying them. I'm trying to lose weight. I'm following this restriction. I really want to have chicken, but it's not on my diet. And I really want to, you know, we've all been through this. And we feel as though we're being betrayed because it's so hard to lose weight. It's the same metabolism, and this is not something that I learned in medical school, that keeps us from gaining too much weight. So we sort of have this like set range, and our bodies are these just wonderful adaptation machines that are just doing their best. If there's not enough calories, as was the case for the eons of human existence until the last couple hundred years, it helped us to not starve. And now, even though we're awash in calories, and people are gaining weight, they're not gaining as much weight as you'd predict based upon what they eat, because again, our bodies are adaptation machines and just trying to do its best to keep us healthy and happy. So have a little grace, understand your body's doing its best, just feed it, nourish it properly, and it can be something that you'll be at peace with.
I think for me, the biggest actionable takeaways are that your weight is not necessarily the best measure of your health. So if you start making better health decisions, like you think you're eating better and you're exercising, but the scale doesn't move, that doesn't mean you failed. You're still vastly improving your health, even if you don't lose any weight. And then also to make changes that you feel like you can actually keep up for the rest of your life, because we think of a diet as a temporary thing. And often exercise programs also are so drastic that they are, you know, a 6-week thing, a 3-month thing. And anything that you only do for 3 months is going to cause weight loss for those 3 months. And then if you go back to what you're eating before, you'll regain the weight and oftentimes more, which is the phenomenon of yo-yo dieting. And so if you actually want to maintain a healthier lifestyle for the rest of your life, it has to be a change that you're okay with making for the rest of your life. So that usually means that it's a pretty small change, which is okay, because small changes over time add up to really big changes. But always being in a rush to make the biggest changes possible is basically a way to ensure failure. So I think just being as patient as possible and making small changes that you can sustain is always going to be a key to long-term success.
Well, Yuna and Eddie, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I could talk with you for much longer, but I want to thank you so much for sharing your insights and your time and more about the work that you've done both with the podcast and the book.
Thank you so much for having us, Audrey. This is so fun.
Thank you so much.
Yuna Jada and Dr. Eddie Phillips are the authors of Food We Need to Talk and co-hosts of the WBUR podcast of the same name. We spoke last year. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then we'll explore the Wisconsin roots of Dungeons & Dragons. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Since it was first created in the 1970s, Dungeons & Dragons has become an international phenomenon. It was the first role-playing game with major commercial success. But few know it all began right here in Wisconsin. Writer T. Krulos uncovers this history in an article he wrote for Milwaukee Magazine. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share that history.
People are actually often surprised to learn that D&D is from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Even folks who are from here. And I think part of that is that the history hasn't necessarily been celebrated locally. But let's dig into it. How did Dungeons & Dragons first come to be?
Yes. Well, it starts with a guy named Gary Gygax and his friend at the time, Dave Arneson. They're both very much into war-playing games and were trying to create their own games, and they kind of put their ideas together and formed this game that really revolutionized the gaming industry called Dungeons & Dragons. And this was the first sort of game where you could interact by sort of becoming one of the characters. You would build your character that was a barbarian or a wizard or some sort of warrior. And then the dungeon master leads your group through this game. And you have to collaborate together to find treasure and fight monsters. And it's a really fun adventure and a way to kind of bond with your fellow game players.
The development of it was interesting. As you say, both Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson were very into war games. I believe that's how they met. Mm-hmm. And Gary, I know, had designed a game called Chainmail.
Right.
This ended up being kind of a game that was really focused on the rules. But as you say, Arneson brought in this idea of kind of character play.
Yeah. Arneson had been working on a game called Blackmore. So, you know, they kind of took some of the best elements of both of those games and created this entirely new thing.
Yeah. Now, as someone who grew up in Lake Geneva, I actually knew Gary Gygax quite well. I also had friends whose parents worked at TSR, which was the company that he made. That has a really complicated history in the city of Lake Geneva. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I mean, one thing that I really love about the story is that Lake Geneva developed this big company. So at one point, they employed like about 400 people, which is a pretty good part of the population of Lake Geneva. You know, they kind of took over the town and imported all of these writers and artists and game editors. And it just must have been like such an exciting time. But, you know, there were some Game of Thrones-style twists to the company, I would say. First, Gygax and Arneson had a bad falling out, and Arneson had to take legal action so he could get a piece of game royalties. And then Gary went from being very poor to being pretty rich in a short amount of space. And I think that a lot of people don't know how to handle that influx of money. So he didn't spend it very wisely, and eventually his own company ousted him from the company in the mid-80s. The new head was a woman named Lorraine Williams, and she ran the company until the late 90s when they were in really bad financial straits, and the company was bought by Wizards of the Coast, which is a company from the Seattle area that created Magic the Gathering. So they bought the company, and they still own it and are producing the game. And it's really kind of amazing. Dungeons & Dragons is still a very popular property, even in this digital age.
It does continue to have a bit of a footprint in Lake Geneva, as you say. A lot of people moved to this small town for this reason. Now, I will say that point in Lake Geneva's history, as somebody who was from there, Lake Geneva also had the Playboy Hotel was just on the outskirts.
Right.
So you have the Playboy Hotel, you have TSR, which is right downtown. It's where the Kilwins ice cream place is now. Mm-hmm. And you, of course, had the lake and all of the tourism that came along with the lake that honestly predates all of this, is really from like the Great Chicago Fire when tourism starts in Lake Geneva.
Right.
But with all of that in mind, it still seems like the city hasn't really latched onto this history in quite the way you might expect for such a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah. It's only been in very recent years that this history is sort of acknowledged and celebrated in any way. But yeah, a long period of time went by. But now there is a group called the Gygax Memorial Fund, and they've slowly been getting some recognition in the city. So, for example, there's some memorial markers by, like, Horticultural Hall, which is where the first Gen Con took place.
Gen Con named for
the Geneva Convention. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that, especially because it's not in Wisconsin anymore, unfortunately. But that's where it started, and it was a very small, humble event. And now it's the largest gaming convention in North America, so 70,000 plus people go to Gen Con nowadays, and it started with less than 100 people. So the Gygax Memorial Fund has also set up a reading alcove in the Lake Geneva Library, which is a beautiful library, by the way. And this alcove includes books that were influential on Gary Gygax. You know, so there's a lot of works by J.R.R. Tolkien and H.P. Lovecraft and stuff like that. And probably the biggest thing that they've been working on, and they've just gotten Lake Geneva to approve this, is they're building a memorial statue of Gary Gygax in the park near the library. And it's going to feature him sitting at a table. And I love this detail. His hand is outstretched, and it's what's called a dice tower. So you drop dice, and it'll come shooting out of his hand onto the table. And people can sit there with him at this table and play Dungeons & Dragons or read a book or do whatever they want. So that's a project that they're currently working on.
Yeah. I was chatting with Gary's widow, Gail Gygax, and I believe they're even going to print some of his original games on the table itself.
Right. Yes, ones that he designed, yeah.
Yeah. Well, T, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
T. Krulos is a writer and author. He joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about D&D in September. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, Ben Wickler will join us to share about his campaign to become the new chair of the Democratic National Committee. Plus, we'll learn about the history of Advent and what it has to do with Christmas. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.